We have a full panel of speakers here. So I'm just going to take a moment and introduce our moderator, Rose Kim, who is an associate professor of sociology at the Borough of Manhattan Community College here at CUNY. Professor Kim co-edited Women on the Role of Public Higher Education and Personal Reflections from CUNY's Graduate Center in 2015, and also Struggle for Ethnic Identities, Narratives by Asian American Professionals in 1999. She previously worked as a reporter at New York Newsday and the Los Angeles Times, and she was part of a team of journalists and photographers that won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage on the 1992 LA riots. And also, in her coverage and in her work, she reexamines her scholarly work given that background and experience. Her other research interests includes racialization, mass media discourse, and public higher education. She's also a member of the board of ARI. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Ari, for helping to organize this conference. I think talking about these issues about citizenship, belonging, and identity in current times is very important. I'm glad to have this opportunity. I'm very pleased and excited to introduce the panelists that we have here today. First, to the far to the right, is Sonia Monchi. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Borough of Manhattan Community College, my colleague, and also we're both Graduate Center. We also attended the Graduate Center. She teaches at the Center for Ethnic Studies. Her research concerns the carceral state, public health, gendered violence, abolitionist feminisms, and racialized immigrants, with a focus on our home borough of Queens. Beside her, we have Elizabeth Oyang, who has been a civil rights attorney and community advocate for more than 30 years and a university educator for nearly 20. Her areas of expertise include voting, census immigration, disability rights, workplace discrimination, media accountability, and combating hate crimes and police brutality. She teaches comparative constitutional challenges impacting African, Latino, and Asian American communities and post-9/11 immigration policies at Columbia University. She also teaches at NYU. Next, we have Kevin Nadal, professor of sociology at both John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the CUNY Graduate Center. He is one of the leading researchers in understanding the mental and physical health of people of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, and other marginalized groups. He's the author of 8 books, including Filipino-American Psychology, A Handbook of Theory Research and Clinical Practice, That's So Gay, Microaggressions in the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community, and Microaggressions and Traumatic Stress. And finally, we have Paramita Shah, a longtime leader in immigrants' rights work related to the criminalization of migration. She provided cutting-edge legal and advocacy support to grassroots groups, organizers, and community stakeholders fighting criminalization and immigration enforcement, and trains legal advocates and lawyers on removal defense. She previously was the Associate Director of the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild from 2005 to April 2019, specializing in strategies to combat immigration, detention, enforcement, and criminalization. She also works on federal and local advocacy campaigns led by organizers and activists fighting increasing criminalization. So thank you all for being here. So I think we can just start with Sonia. And so if you could speak about any projects that you have worked on with community organizations or activists, if you could just share some information about them and any difficulties, challenges, and also positive experiences that you could discuss.
So thank you so much, Rose, for the very big, broad question as an opening. I will just say a little bit about some of the work that I've done. But I wanted to say, actually, first that I think, you know, one of the things that I've been really thinking about and sort of struggling with or navigating myself is this kind of the language that we use to differentiate scholars and activists. As we know, it's a false binary, but we still use it. And I think I've been trying to understand, like, what is the more precise, what is it that we're actually trying to say when we're making that differentiation? And is it about, you know, location of where we do our work or who we're engaging in our work, the goals, the pace of work, the scope of work, the methods? And I think the reason I want to raise that early on is because I think that, you know, for me, I don't identify as a scholar activist, although that label has been given to me often. And I have a little bit of a discomfort with it. And I don't have a better term in the moment, but it's something that I'm curious to hear from others about how you sort of think about where you're located. Because I think for me, you know, what I think about a lot is my praxis and how my praxis is grounded in a long history of women of color feminisms and myself as an individual, as a South Asian queer cisgender woman. I embody multiple positions and roles and relationships. And as I navigate, I mean, as so many of us do, as probably all of us do, and so as I navigate through different sites, you know, what I have is like that through line is my consistent political and intellectual commitment. So, for example, in my case, those commitments are to prison abolition and to transformative justice. So that shapes a lot of how I show up in different sites, whether I'm there primarily as a scholar or as a community member or as a neighbor or as an educator. And so, you know, I just wanted to say that I think for me, you know, how I'm going to be answering these questions or how I came to this panel thinking about the questions that were posed to us earlier is about, you know, how does that praxis operate and how am I seen in these different spaces as well? Because one of the things I really appreciated about the earlier panel was when the earlier panelists talked about the pressures of the neoliberal university. And I think one of the questions I have for us as members of the neoliberal university is also how do we then internalize those pressures and, you know, selectively reward or exclude each other based on those types of affiliations and labels. And I can say more about that later. But to Rose's question, I think for me, you know, this praxis has meant a lot of collaboration with others across all of the different scopes, sites of my work. So a lot of collaboration with faculty members as well, who also occupy different position. So, for example, Rose was part of one project that I co-directed with colleagues from Queens College and Hunter College and BMCC. That was an NEH-funded project called Building Asian American Studies Across the Community College Classroom, and Ari supported that work quite a bit. And so this was a project that was more housed in the university, but it was thinking through how do we expand teaching Asian American studies in community college classrooms, which traditionally don't have space for ethnic studies. BMCC is unique in the CUNY system in that we do have a center for ethnic studies. But this was really an effort to think about, well, okay, in our disciplines, like if we're teaching English or psychology or sociology or history, how do we incorporate more Asian American studies content into that, those spaces? And so through that work, we really wanted to develop a locally relevant Asian American studies, which was working through what Robin Kelly calls a polycultural framework, thinking about interrelationships between different cultures and different communities. And so our work really engaged different community-based organizations throughout New York City, where our students live and work, to kind of understand the local conditions and what would like sort of a live Asian American studies look like, and to sort of complicate the boundary between the classroom and community to see more of a continuum of our students' lives, and then understand how as Asian American studies scholars we can address issues that impact people's everyday living, but also through a scholarly lens. And so I'll just stop there as one project, and then I am happy to talk about other community-based work I've done around gender-based violence, which is my area of research.
Hi, I'm Liz, and I want to thank Joyce and Claire and Tony for putting this on, very timely, specifically the topic of citizenship. As we talk right now, the United States Supreme Court is deliberating on whether or not to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. And how I have intertwined my work and the community in response to Professor Margaret Chin's question, as an adjunct faculty person, Columbia and NYU, there's very little research money out there to do community-based research. So being a community activist, being a civil rights attorney, I take those roles and I market myself as a consultant to various community-based groups working on current and pressing topics. And then through that consultancy, I can then, while I'm being paid to work on those projects, I can gather the research that I will need later to do scholarly research. And so that's one way to help pay for the research that I want to do. It doesn't cover everything, but it sure helps a lot. So let me give you an example. I was hired as a consultant by the New York Immigration Coalition to form and grow the first ever statewide coalition on the census in New York State. And so it was called New York Counts 2020. And it was really important for community-based groups to be part of this coalition because $800 billion are allocated a year based on census results, on population counts. And so all of our communities are impacted. But this was a way for APA groups, small and large, to play a part in this statewide coalition to have their voices heard. And so it was not difficult to get APA groups involved because they had a vested interest in the outcome of this 2020 census, and particularly this question, which will be divisive if added, which will, by all counts, by all experts' counts, lead to an undercount that will skew statistics and research that many people in this room rely on. So you're going to be doing research for 10 years based on inaccurate data if this citizenship question is added. And how does that play out? So, for instance, New York Immigration Coalition itself receives $820,000 from the Corporation for Natural and Community Services for 21 AmeriCorps VISTA positions at the NYIC. CPC, Chinese American Planning Council, in fiscal year 2017 and 2018, received $6.2 million for child education, infant and toddler services, senior services, career services, nutrition services, based on federal programs, money that's allocated based on census information. And Charles B. Wong Community Health Center sees 58,000 patients a year. They work closely with hospital and healthcare institutions to target intervention that addresses disease and mortality. They identify health patterns across race and ethnicity based on the census. So you can imagine that if there is inaccurate data, they are doing planning regarding health prevention and diseases, you know, based on faulty data that, you know, could impact in our health care and generations of people as a result. You know, and the list goes on. And, you know, Arab American Association of New York was heavily involved. There currently is no Middle East and North African category to, you know, check off in the census. And with the current ICE enforcement and distrust and use of past census data to locate Arab and South Asian communities for ICE, a further decrease by the citizenship question and the fear that that will infuse will lead to extremely faulty data. So we work heavily with many Asian American organizations who were part of New York Counts 2020 in coming up with public comment period letters to you know, speak out against adding the citizenship question. The 7-day trial in New York, where we challenged the New York Attorney General's office on behalf of 18 states, challenged the addition of that citizenship question. We, the community, monitored that trial. I just came back from the Supreme Court arguments. We went at 2 o'clock in the morning to wait in line to be able to get in to hear those arguments. And we filed an amicus curiae brief on the Supreme Court case on behalf of organizations who are going to be impacted. And that decision is about to come out in mid-June. And so this conference is very timely. And the second that I want to raise is, again, as a consultant, I was hired by APA Voice, Asian Pacific American, voting and organizing to increase civic engagement, to coordinate the largest ever so far in this race, in the Queens DA's race. Queens DA, the current DA, Richard Brown, is retiring after 28 years. So imagine that, you guys. In 1990, the Asian American population was in Queens was around 207,000. Now it's more than doubled, you know, and it's close to 23% of Queens population. And the Queens office has not been in touch with these changes. Queens is more than 50% minority now, yet 70% of the attorneys in the Queens DA's office is white. Based on the Queens DA's own records. And so, you know, clearly, issues of representation and language access is critical in this race, as well as ICE arrests at the courthouse. And hate crimes that have gone up exponentially. I was just yesterday on a 6 train going from 51st Street to Astor Place. And before that, at a stop, the door opened. Asian American male student gets on the train. Following him was a white man. You know, also young, heavier than the Asian guy, and in his face said, "I can fucking break your neck, chink," and then just left the train. We were just, everybody was so shocked, you know, and I'm the only one who went up to the Asian American male student, and I said, "You know, are you okay?" And he goes, "Yeah," he was really shocked. And I said, "Did something happen on the platform? You know?" And he goes, "No." He goes, "I didn't even see him." He goes, "When the door opened, I was first in line. And, you know, he had to have been behind me because I was first in line. I didn't even see where he came from." And you know, these incidences are rising. You know, in Queens, Asian Americans are the second most arrested for prostitution and sex worker trafficking issues. Again, an issue in how the Queens DA's office is handling that. But what's critical is our APA organizations, what role they're going to play with respect to the status quo or reform of the criminal justice system with this election. So it's very, very key. Many of the groups that are part of APA Voice sponsoring civic engagement around this race weren't even in existence 28 years ago. You know what I mean? Especially the Southeast and the South Asian groups. And so, you know, this is a critical election which they need to weigh in on.
I'm just happy to be having this conversation. These are conversations that I often have behind closed doors with friends and family. And so to be able to have this more public setting, curious to see what we all come up with as a community. So I actually do identify as a scholar activist, and part of the reason is because when people think of a scholar, they don't necessarily think of people that look like us. And so having that visual and that assertion of us being scholars and activists or psychologists or social workers or whatever it is that we need to have more representation of is something that's important for me. In fact, a colleague of mine, Sylvia Mazzulla, and I started a campaign called hashtag This Is What a Professor Looks Like, because when people, when you Google the word professor, what pops up are these stock images of white men in tweed jackets. No one's wearing tweed. I said that one time, and someone's wearing tweed. And to know that we are also what professors look like, and in fact, with our changing demographics, to know that we not only are what professors do look like, but we are what professors should look like. When I think about the CUNY system specifically, where anywhere from 70 to 80% of our students are students of color, and anywhere from 70 to 80% of our faculty are white, that's a problem that we need to address. And so for me, my activism is so embedded in my scholarship, and it's also just important for me to be more vocal on that. I know also as a caveat that it comes with the privilege that I've now attained having gone through the ranks of academia. And as a full professor, I can pretty much say whatever I want and not get fired for it. But I also recognize that that's now a responsibility that I have for speaking up, especially when there are untenured or adjunct faculty members who might not be able to say certain things. So that's where my activism comes in. My activism comes in my research, in my writing. The types of things that I research are not just important for me and my communities and people who identify in the same way that I do, but things that I genuinely believe need to be addressed and written about. So many of our stories are not included in the narrative, and part of that is because many of us don't have the opportunity to share those voices or those perspectives. And so I view that as a responsibility for me to do. And so with that, with a lot of the research that I do, I make sure that it's not just something that I publish in an academic journal and then just sits there for maybe other graduate students and maybe other academics to read, but something that I try to distribute to community organizations. I'm very active in a lot of different community organizations, both locally and nationally, and that's something that I don't think a lot of faculty members are doing. A lot of folks, even if they do community-based research, oftentimes will just go and collect their data and then never come back to the organizations. Sometimes people ask me, like, how do you collect data so quickly? I say it's because I'm part of the community and they happily give me data. Versus if you're somebody who they never see, there's a lot of trust and buy-in that they might not want to participate in your studies. And so I think that's something that's really important for us as researchers and scholars to really address, that we're not just using our communities to get tenure and promotion and to get the publications, but that we actually are invested and actually part of those communities too. The different organizations I work with include the Asian American Psychological Association. I was formerly the president. And one of the things that we've been doing is really addressing mental health issues within Asian American communities. With that, it's providing the research, providing the clinical perspectives, providing the scholarship and writing, making sure that we destigmatize mental health stigma within Asian American communities. With that comes looking at specific ethnic group issues, religion, within group dynamics, colorism, addressing all the things within the Asian American community that we oftentimes either don't want to address or are too privileged to even recognize that certain dynamics exist. I'm also a trustee of the Philippine American National Historical Society, and with that organization, it's really been an opportunity for us to reflect on history and how history is basically repeating. When we look at some of the immigration policies and practices, procedures that are happening now, that these are the very same things that happened to many of us and our communities in prior to the 1960s and even in the 1960s. And so using history as a way of understanding how things have progressed and also as a way of connecting to it. A lot of Asian Americans, particularly for those who are of ethnic groups that have been here for such a long time, they have such skewed limited views of immigration, not recognizing that they themselves are the beneficiaries of this immigration system, and that they also had problems prior to the Immigration Act being passed. And so, you know, I think it's important for us to really reflect on that history as well. Using my research, I've been really intentional of being part of different ways of disseminating that research. So, for example, I've been privileged enough to be able to use my research as part of expert witness testimonies for court cases, which is something that most academics aren't trained to do or don't even know how to navigate that. Something I had to train myself to do. So I think that's something that faculty members need to be more well-versed in or learn how to go through that process. And even just working with national organizations like the National Institutes on Health or SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health and Services Agency, and producing different types of materials for them that helps them to see their work through this cultural lens. Finally, just being active in community organizations doesn't have to be necessarily, you know, being on a board or consulting or doing workshops, even though it could be. But it also could just be showing up. How many of us actually just show up to the festivals and the barbecues and the church functions, introduce yourselves, let people know what it is that you do, and how might just that idea or that very just small innocuous act of showing up and introducing yourself, talking about some of your work, be a little piece of activism that gets folks to talk about certain issues. So, for example, when I go to places and I'm a psychologist by training, people say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a psychologist by training, and I research mental health issues related to historically marginalized communities, including Asian Americans. I say something like that, and they'll say, like, oh, mental health. And then they start talking about mental health. So having those conversations are just small, but they're vital for us to destigmatize. I think in recent years, mental health, for example, has been talked about a lot more in our communities, more than it ever had been. We see op-ed pieces, we see videos coming out. The young people, millennials especially, are talking about their experiences out loud. And I think part of that is because there have been folks that have been more willing to step up and to have those conversations, to initiate those conversations. And so I hope that we all are able to do that. So I'll end there for now.
Thank you, Ari, for having me here. I'm a immigration lawyer by training. And so I've been working on deportation and detention for about 20 years now, mostly focusing on people who have criminal convictions. And so as we are in this meeting today where we're talking about white supremacy and we're talking about white nationalism and citizenship, I think it's interesting because at this confluence of our immigration system and our criminal justice system, or our criminal legal system rather, we really see the xenophobia and the racism fully baked in. And I think that's something we kind of instinctively see every day. But when you see people who are incarcerated for a long period of time, or you see people who are fighting for their loved ones, for them to get out, you can see all the evils that drive all our communities to deportation, to prisons, to poverty. And I think that's just a very much a shared experience that we have. And even though we're at this time where we're talking about citizenship, right, and the census, and we're talking about the ban, and we're talking about, you know, the proposals to reduce immigration to the United States. We're also talking about a time where, you know, for me, I think, because we are talking about scholars, that the information is, the bigotry is out, but the data that shows that is really in. And it's really hard to see, it's hard to collect, and it's hard to show. And when we think of data, or we think of information collection as a way to expose, you know, that kind of bigotry in our systems, I think of scholars also needing to build a narrative a critical narrative that will tie these very complicated pieces together. Because it is a very complicated story in our schools, and I'm experiencing this now as a mother of a middle schooler. You know, we started at the Civil War, and then we leap, you know, really to the civil rights movement. And it's funny because in that period of time, we had really the backlash against communities of color, where we saw Jim Crow laws just blow up, right? The terroristic lynchings across the country. We also saw the Chinese Exclusion Act. We saw Japanese internment camps, right? We saw a range of very ugly criminalization, incarceration, and we don't really document it, I think, for our stakeholders. I live in Washington, D.C., nor do we really tie it amongst our movements in a way that people can talk about it. I think one of the most beautiful recent displays of that activism that I saw was a group that we have close ties with called Grassroots Leadership in Texas. And they did a event with, I think, the Japanese Citizens League, where they tied family separation, right, and child imprisonment, which is happening right now under zero tolerance policies, with Japanese internment. And that produced a conversation that is absolutely critical because it is not divorced, actually, right, from, I think, the decades and from the birth of the United States, which was built with the birth with the major defect of slavery, right? And that has actually informed all our immigration laws and much of our social policy for the last many years. And so the way that I think about the work that I do is, and I do work on hunger striker cases of Bangladeshis that are detained in Texas, or the Minnesota 8 cases, which this amazing group of Cambodian activists who are building campaigns against the DA, but also against ICE to fight against the deportation of their family members back to Cambodia. Or a number of other hunger strikers of Punjabi Sikhs, right? Or the work that CIRAC does or SALT does, a number of organizations that we've worked with, where I think the addition of a lawyer or a scholar activist really allows power, right, to build, to change a conversation locally. And that's what I think we're talking about. We have a conversation about all of this because we're trying to change the power structure. And so the ways that I think of, you know, these are very kind of maybe very five discrete ways that I think about how scholars work with us. There's kind of this, you know, more recently we produced a report with Mi Gente and the Immigrant Defense Project, which is based in Boston, called No Tech for ICE. That was in my previous job. And we hired a researcher to expose, I think, the role of corporations, the privatization of our identities, right, that is being sold to others for the purpose of building social programs that will benefit us. And we haven't yet had a conversation yet about what it means to have a smart city, right, versus having a city that profiles us every day, right? And so we need to have those conversations. That's where a researcher would be really helpful. And that's why we hired a researcher to help us do that, because it's not just a legal conversation, even though it is for me in my mind. We need to build a strategy table on how to figure out how to fight it. And that's what this all is, our mini strategy tables on fighting things, right? There's another group called TREC, Transactional Research Access Center, where they collect and file FOIAs all the time, Freedom of Information Act requests, or local FOIAs. And that really allows communities to access that information and figure out how they might use that in their campaigns. And that's how I use, you know, I've had many law school clinics, many researchers who've done that. In a gang campaign in where we were trying to bring down a, you know, working with a organizing group in Chicago, organized communities against deportation, and Black Youth Project 100, where a gang database had 96% of the gang database was Black and Latino youth, right? It was several research institutions that were able to get that information, pull it out, right, of the database, and work with campaigns that were trying to have a conversation with police departments to shut it down. That's another way. And the last thing I would talk about would be the role of scholars as expanding imagination, right? I think in times of crisis, in times of deep rigidity, right, where the obstacles look really hard, it is absolutely critical for scholars to develop imaginative, provocative writings and scholarship that will help us expand. So the abolition work that you're talking about is absolutely essential. Why do we have abolish ICE? People like to have debates about a hashtag, but for me, we should really be talking about what does it mean to reach towards abolition? What does it mean? How does that impact your strategy moving backwards? And how does a researcher connect with that? How does a lawyer connect with it? How does an activist connect with it? How do we all connect with it? And so I think that's when you have the right end goal, you have really an ability to connect strategies that I think build power that we've been doing for a long time, but we feel like the exposure is not enough. Right now, we need to say we are fighting for something very provocative and make it real. And I think scholars really have an obligation to do that. If you don't make it real from the beginning, I don't think it's going to be real for the practitioners around the country who want to do something provocative but don't have anything to point to. And so I think that's where I'm going to leave it. But, you know, for me on the civil rights work for hunger strikers, it's very easy for me to say those people should be released. And you know what? The government should pay them because they were abused while they were detained. And I think, you know, instead of us kind of being limited by what is rights, what are our due process, we all know what liberation looks like around, you know, at the end of the road for all of us. We know that it looks like healthy communities and thriving communities and communities that are engaged in the system. I think now we just have to figure out the right angle and make it our goal so that we can backtrack the strategies that elevate that.
Thank you, everyone. I'm glad, Sonia. Well, first of all, just I wanted to mention that the NEH program, summer program, was really amazing. Just wanted to say that. Thank you for your comments. I'm glad that Sonia brought up that issue about the scholar activists, because before we sat down, Paramita had asked me, you know, how are you defining scholar? And I think, you know, the discussion that you guys had is great. I think this connects with the earlier panel just about talking about the neoliberal university, because the position of scholar is so tenuous now. I mean, when I started teaching full-time at CUNY in 2007, I think we were like at 70% were adjuncts. Now it's inching up to like 80%. It's over 75%. And we know that there are adjunct professors who are living on food stamps, living in their cars, and that, you know, within the university, there's this enormous hierarchy and inequality. At BMCC, where I teach, I'm teaching 5 classes. I'm just, you know, in addition to like the research and putting on a symposium there, I'm just like, my brain is just fried. And I think, you know, the work conditions that we have are, you know, really unbearable. And there's not, you know, and I think, you know, that's a real issue. And the whole, you know, in speaking with Paramita also, I was just saying that I'm also have uneasiness about that position of being the expert or the authority or the one who has the knowledge. I mean, often, you know, people who may not have the degree may know so much more than we do, you know. So, and I think there's also a transition from activists into scholarship. You have someone like Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who was an activist, and, you know, her activists built up her scholarship, and, you know, her work has been powerful. So would anyone like to comment further about that scholarship, scholar activism divide, or the state of the university?
I would just say that, to me, and our campaign said activists actually represent the best experts. So the directly impacted person is the best expert, we feel like, in all the campaign work, because they actually experience it. To me, scholars are just like lawyers, like really good writers. We're professionalized. Like, you know, we know how to navigate systems. You know, I think those are the skill set that we bring, but it's not the elitism that you're talking about that we bring into the the work or the scholarship?
I would say exactly that, that the activism scholar, you know, brings out a perspective that's often left out, and that is the community perspective, the voices of the people that are impacted. You know, as a legal activist, I know how the law does or does not fit our communities. But to translate that into the impact on the daily level is the community-based group, the stories of someone who is now cut from, you know, WIC or child assistance programs because they weren't counted in the census for the next 10 years. And what's that going to do to that family? You know, it's the stories. It's the stories that drive public opinion. You know, you have to have the statistics, the research to back it up. But it's the human stories that drive public opinion.
I wanted to give some context to my why I said that. And I think, you know, I really appreciated what you said, Kevin, about sort of the kind of being in community and showing up as part of what it means to be a scholar in community. I think, you know, why I said that has a lot to do with the economics of the university. My trajectory is that for about 10 years, I was working in community-based organizations. I worked as a staff member in an organization that works on gendered violence in the South Asian community, but I was also involved in other organizations in New York City that work on immigrant rights and work in LGBTQ communities of color. And so I had this sort of intersectional praxis, not in a university, and I went to graduate school in large part to deeply study some of the conditions that we were working in. This is like post 9/11, and there was a lot of change in our different kind of organizing strategies. And so I think that, you know, it's not that I am against the concept of a scholar activist, but what I've noticed now that I am a professional in the university, but I teach at a community college and I'm untenured, that the label of scholar activism often gets applied to me in a way that I feel discredits my scholarship. And so it sort of is a reminder. It's like a, you know, it's not as so much as like how I see myself, but how I have seen how in settings that are not, you know, my annual review with my chair, but a conference, like an ethnic studies conference or an Asian American studies conference, where we are together as scholars, there's a differentiation between scholars and scholar activists, and I've become sensitive to how that is applied to me in some ways to discredit my work in a way that also teaches me a lot more about how, you know, how we understand expertise. And where we challenge that, you know, I think what Paramita just said is really important. Like, if we think about ourselves as scholars alongside communities-based scholars, right, it shifts a little bit about where we see knowledge being produced and our relationships together in community with one another and how we're sort of collectively thinking through and disseminating our work in different spaces. And, you know, so just to say a little bit of that context, and I think that the other thing about the economics of this is that, you know, our pacing is different. So, for instance, like, I have a long list of all the different research projects I would love to do in the communities that I'm committed to and will be committed to regardless of my academic position, but I don't have time because of my workload. So, you know, those are the costs of the benefit of having, I'm very privileged that I have a salaried position in the university, and I don't take that for granted at all, but then there's also the realities of how much time I have for my research. And so, you know, for me, what that has meant is, as my own productivity is slower, I'm also contributing to others' productivity in the sense of like working on collective projects that are not based in the university, as well as keeping my relationships. Like, so trying to show up as much as possible, because that is also contributing to change, right? So some of the work that I've been involved in, I'm also working on the DA accountability campaign in Queens with a working group that's part of a coalition that's, the working group that I'm part of is really focused on criminalized survivors and trying to get the DA candidates. They have successfully gotten the DA candidates to publicly commit to not prosecuting survivors of violence who are criminalized for acts of survival. We'll see what happens when they're elected, but at least there is this public commitment that has been made. I'm also part of a neighborhood-based group that is successfully fighting development in Queens, and I'm part of a research and education committee because that's a skill set I have. But I'm taking leadership from the people who are most directly impacted by gentrification and development in my neighborhood, which is also the neighborhood I grew up in. But in this moment, because of my salaried position, I'm not at most risk of displacement in my neighborhood. And then also, I've been participating in providing research and education support to people throughout the United States who want to work on issues of criminalized survivors. And so just to think about, you know, none of these projects have resulted in an academic publication for me. My name is not on any of these things, but I'm participating in them because they're part of my work. And then ultimately, I am starting a research project now that I have a little bit more time. That is building from the work that I've been doing in these different spaces and is actually focused on concerns of mental health. So I'd love to talk to Kevin later about some of the things that we're seeing show up in these neighborhood spaces. I wouldn't have come to this project that I'm working on now had I not been continuing my community work even outside of the sort of like direct link to my academic scholarship. A lot of my current research project is also informed by my conversations with my students because my students are New York City community members and share what's happening in their lives. And so to say that I think a lot of the method for me is about active listening and to really make those connections, even if it doesn't look like the sort of traditional productivity and dissemination that we expect often of ourselves in the university.
I would just add that, you know, we don't have the difference between a scholar and a scholar activist is that a scholar activist, what we do is specifically to move the needle. You know, we don't have the luxury to want, even if we have a desire to research something that's less timely, that's more esoteric, more, you know, of cultural interest. There's just too much happening now. That as an activist scholar, what we strategically write, work, and concentrate on is done with the purpose of moving the needle.
One of the things that reminded me of is how many of us doing the work that we do are often labeled as like, oh, they do that multicultural work. Oh, they do Asian American work, as opposed to seeing as like, no, we're doing immigration work. No, we're doing mental health work. But because it has anything to do with social justice, that it's oftentimes either degraded or watered down or that sort of thing. And I think that's important for us to call out and to, when someone says things like that, to say things like, well, what do you mean by that? And to acknowledge, for them to acknowledge that they have some bias when it comes to the types of research that we do. And I also think about just this idea of scholar activism as a term that I've used. I've actually wrote a paper on in The American Psychologist called On Being a Psychologist Activist. And part of the reason for that, the intended audience was people who already integrate activism into their work people who never think about activism, because why aren't they psychologist activism? Why activists? Why aren't they integrating issues of social justice into every aspect of their work? And so for them, it's being able to identify that as a reminder of integrating that. And then the other piece that I was thinking about is this idea of elitism that was brought up, and just this notion that it used to be that when you became a professor, that you were a scholar and you knew everything and you could, you know, whatever you say was the truth. But I think for those of us who are now in the academy and changing the face of what that looks like, there is a certain humility that comes with it. There's a collectivism that comes with it. And that we really need to queer up what being a professor is or what being a scholar is, that it should be somebody who refers back to what community members are saying. It should be somebody who's able to cite somebody who didn't have access to the paper or to the Twitter following or to whatever it might be. And that's something that's been something that I've done, but I haven't, you know, had a lot of models to see that that's how it should and could be done, because you know, previous generations have been trying so hard just to fit into this neoliberal university, fit into this white male heterosexual cisgender standard, and that we have this opportunity as well as this responsibility to change what that looks like. You know, I'm one of the things that's really, you know, important for me is this balance of acknowledging the privilege and then knowing what to do with that privilege. So I've been asked to be a consultant for many different organizations where the people of color and the queer and trans people have been saying things for decades about the organization, and the higher ups don't hear anything. So they said, we really need to hire a consultant. So they find me and they bring me in. And essentially they pay me to say, like, listen to what all these folks are saying. Because that's the privilege that I have. They weren't listening to these folks. And for me to, because I have these letters behind my name, to say that to them, and to back it up with research, and to say things that maybe those folks either can't say out loud or in the way that they really want to say to them. But now they brought me in, and so I have that privilege and that responsibility, like to actually criticize the organization and be like, this organization is racist AF, or this organization has a lot of problems, you all need to do things about it. So it's hard, because then it's like, okay, now they brought me in and they're going to pay me, so what do I do with them not listening to the folks to begin with? But then at the same time, I also know that they wouldn't have even listened to the folks that were there in the organization had they not brought in an outside person and who is an expert and a scholar. So it's resolving, like, how can I feel good about all these things? What is the end goal? What is what are some ways that we can lead to some change, and, you know, what are the strategies to be able to do that?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Sonia mentioned being untenured, because I am tenured. And yeah, I no longer care about, you know, that label or how people perceive me. And, you know, the earlier panel discussion just about maintaining that objectivity of the social scientist, I've totally thrown that out. I think that, you know, the act of listening, being fair and conscientious, and it's interesting. Just, I mean, that term scholar, it does make me sort of uneasy. I value what you're saying, but then I think about, you know, Patrick Moynihan talking about culture of poverty. I think about the scientists, you know, U.S. scientists who infected children in Guatemala with syphilis just to see what penicillin would do. So scholars have a horrible history of violence and, you know, serving white supremacy and power. And it's interesting. I mean, I feel like I've been reading a lot just about, like, the power struggle 60s and the rise of black power. I've been reading Walter Rodney. And, you know, a big goal in that time was to really reform education, to really create, to create this history that we should have. And, you know, even before slavery, there was the genocide of the Native Americans. So, you know, the violence of the state is frightening. And that narrative is still not effectively incorporated into American history. I mean, the earlier panel talking about how Asian American history is not included in various state curriculums. And, you know, as great as that NEH summer workshop was, Sonia, it was like 98% Asian. So, you know, we were there, we were excited, and I got a lot of new information, and yet, you know, where was everyone else? And also, I just want to tie in, because we are sort of running out of time, but I also loved what Russell was saying in the previous panel, and that idea of uniting under a world majority people. And in reading Walter Rodney now, he talks about, you know, understanding this system of white power that is a global network encompass, you know, and that we are all tied together in this imperial project and suffer as people of being non-white. And I find that sort of a powerful coming together. I think that ties in earlier also about this idea of empathy and about coalitions and, you know, instead of being in our multicultural silos of Chinese, Korean, or South Asian, or East Asian, there is this pervasive oppression that we all face all the time. And, you know, the U.S. is at war with 7 countries, and they're dropping 4 bombs an hour, every hour. So, if anyone...
What is the question?
question.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing about identity, that whole thing about thinking about us as, you know, majority world people, since this title is about identity and belonging. And I think, like, you know, so much of this violence that we're seeing is just being enforced on these non-citizens, you know, so that citizenship itself is a form of horrible violence. How do we rethink our alliances and coalitions? Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think this is, there's a worldwide shift to the right, right? I mean, I think we're seeing it in India, we're seeing it in China, we're seeing it here. This is a worldwide shift. And so now the question is in my mind, like, how do you, are there interventions to build solidarity? I think that's, everyone's looking for the intervention to build solidarity, and that really takes just time and work, the hard work that you guys are doing here. But I guess to your question as to how it impacts our work directly, is that right? Like,
how should we think about identity or coalitions? What is that important?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, the reason why immigration is the laboratory that the United States experiments on, right, is because it's so vulnerable, right? It's easy to get, it's easy to hide, right, to incarcerate. It's easy to deport, and then you never know what happened. I think what it will take now is, like, honestly, as we build coalition spaces, I think the new generation of activists that we have, one thing that I'm actually, I don't know if anyone else is worried about, is many of them grew up during the time of Obama, right? And the resilience is different, right? And the muscle is different. And so the muscle that we have to build now to have coalitions and to withstand, which I think will be very long-term oppressive tactics beyond Trump, right? Because all he's done is set up the architecture. It's not that we have, once he leaves, it's not that we don't have a new Supreme Court and a reshaping of all the courts in the United States. It's not as if he hasn't shifted funding and taken away funding from the EPA that's going to change our drinking water. It's not that we have, you know, all these climate change like disasters that we're going to have to, like, those are going to continue to happen. And I guess for me, it is connecting with, I think, our own oppressive behaviors in India, right, with caste system, a resurgence of caste violence, and making sure that those stories, you know, I think are talked about and heard within the narrative that we're building now. We're globalized, so I think we have a way to build it. But we don't have an investment into, we're not going to have government investment, which is necessary, into that storytelling. And that's why I think the revolution will never be funded, really, through neoliberal institutions. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I just view this as an opportunity. Actually, I think in the South, the most interesting coalitions are built. Not because it's easy, but because it's so hard, you know? And I think when it's really hard, you can really build beautiful coalitions. And I think that's just something for us to remember as we talk about resilience, is that we have so many shared objectives, but when it's really hard, we have much more generosity to, like, build it.
I think it's really, really important as activist scholars that definitely for our students, particularly, that we put things in context and to expose the elephants in the room that are behind many racist policies that appear neutral but are really racist in intention. So on the screen, as you see, a lot of what's been happening, the attack on affirmative action, the addition of the citizenship question to the census, the revamping of or attempts to revamp our immigration system and to move from a family-based system to a skills-based system that will impact the numbers and types of people who come into the country is very much based on fear. Fear that our country in 2050 will be a majority minority country. As you see from the statistics, predictions and in part based on census data, which, as we know, there is already underreporting and at risk of great underreporting as a result of this potential citizenship question added. But in any regards, current predictions. In 2050, Africans will be 15% of the population. Latinos will have doubled since 2080 to 30%. Asians almost doubled to 9.2%. Since 2008. And so together, that's 54.2%. Predictions now are that we're going to reach a majority minority country in 2045. But you can see what this means for coalition building, right? We've been so far a majority white country. And where have Asians played a role in this white nationalism? You know, we see now an uptake in hate crimes. We see now still a severe underrepresentation in the highest offices of, you know, 500 companies. Great barriers and white ceilings in so many different professions where Asian Americans are not traditionally represented. And so what's going to happen in 2050? You know, and what are we doing now to prepare and build those coalitions? You know, are Asian Americans going to build the alliances that are needed with African and Latino communities to benefit from being a majority-minority country in 2050? Are we making those efforts? You know, are we consciously thinking of how we're doing that? Or are we going to let ourselves be co-opted, used, manipulated again, to form a majority with the minority white population in 2050, when, you know, all the policies leading up to that has been exclusionary, you know, and we are not a part of this white nationalism, you know, and, you know, so this is a critical question. You know, are we going to take control of our identity, you know, and are we going to benefit from the changing demographics in this country, you know, and, you know, where are our alliances going to be, and are we exercising that right now? The candidates forum that I was hired to organize, you know, strategically, you know, we wanted faith in New York, and Common Cause, and to reach out to NAACP and other organizations, you know, even though it had to be led by APA Voice, it needed to be also in collaboration with other non-APA groups to show solidarity and to show commonality. But, you know, are we strategically thinking that way?
I mean, one of the things that I have been thinking about a lot lately and has been coming up in a lot of Asian American organizations that I'm part of is, can we handle all of our within group stuff first, which then could be helpful in handling our coalition building? Because it seems that, you know, oftentimes there's an Asian American agenda that's being pushed that doesn't represent all of what Asian Americans are and who it gets included in that. And it also feels like, you know, I hope that generationally, when it comes to 2050, that this point, that there could be an opportunity for Asian Americans to have that that knowledge, that education, that wokeness about social justice issues that might be different than what they currently are. So, for example, when we have a lot of Asian Americans who are anti-affirmative action and are anti-black and very vocal about some of those things, that presents a divided community, which then doesn't serve us in general or as a whole. And so what I'm hoping is that with the younger generations who are more vocal about anti-blackness and are more aware of how things like affirmative action are beneficial for our communities, that might be something that, you know, we have to push for in order for that 2050 coalition building to take place. But going on to back to the idea of, can we talk about our within group issues? Most Asian American organizations that I'm part of, nobody wants to talk about colorism. Nobody wants to talk about the divides between brown Asians and East Asians and Southeast Asians. Nobody wants to talk about the certain issues that affect certain groups that don't affect other groups. And it's similar to any other community. In the same way that LGBTQ communities push this gay agenda, which is not reflective of trans people or queer people of color, and yet it's presumed to be the main agenda. And so I have a real problem when we see headlines that say things like Asian Americans against affirmative action, when in reality, one, that's not the truth, that's not a majority of Asian Americans, but two, why is it that the groups that are pushing for that are not necessarily reflective of some of the subgroups and the historically marginalized groups within Asian American communities? So that's a challenge that I hope we have a better time and better, or we are more able to talk about. My last piece is I have a paper coming out in the next couple of weeks called The Brown Asian American Movement, and just calling out all these things that we never want to talk about. And in many ways, the messages that I receive as a Filipino American within Asian American community, and I know a lot of my other Southeast Asian siblings say as well, is that people will say things like, why do you have to talk about that? You're just dividing us. Or they'll say things like, you know, when you sound so angry when you talk about those issues. That's the same thing that white people are saying to all of you all. So why is it that now that's something that then becomes perpetuated within our own communities? And so to be really mindful of the within group issues that we experience, that many of us who do belong to these historically marginalized groups, which also includes gender and sexual orientation and social class and religion, that we know it and see it all the time. But if you have those privileged lenses, you might not recognize that at all. As just a final example, why is it that Crazy Rich Asians has been pushed at this Asian American movie when there have been hella movies that have featured brown Asians that aren't pushed in that same way? Why is it that we celebrate certain people as Asian American and then we label other people as being South Asian, which is very empowering for South Asian people, but then that means that the general Asian American community doesn't view them. They're still being othered and labeled as such. And so for us to just be critical on that. And finally, where do Filipinos fit in? Because we're oftentimes left out of the conversation altogether, even though we are 20% of the Asian American community. And so things for us to think about.
Thank you. I want to open the floor to questions. I think we are coming up on lunch and the end of the panel soon, so I'd like to get the audience in. Yes, please.
What's missing in the conversation is U.S. foreign policy that is driving the immigration problem. It's kind of a blowback type of situation where, for example, in Central America, we're seeing large influx of immigrants as a consequence of our policies from the 1980s. And even the current policy when Secretary of State Clinton had orchestrated the overthrow of Zelaya, which is never talked about, which is the driving force. And if you talk about the Middle East, it's our Middle East policy, 9/11, false flag, the war on terror. That's driving the immigration crisis in Europe, in Middle East to Europe. So you see a large influx of Europe of immigrants from the war, especially from Syria and Iraq, going to Europe, and that's where you get the backlash. It's our foreign policy that's driving it, which is a form of white supremacy. So our focus should be, as part of this discussion, should be focused on our current foreign policy. And right now, I think there's a large military contingent that's going to Iran right now that's being driven by neoconservatives like Bolton, who are part of the Trump administration, that's driving this war policy that will, if it does happen, would create a greater immigration crisis now. So I think that's where our focus should be on, the primary cause of our crisis today.
So I'm very curious to ask you, so right now 22% of the U.S. population suffer from colonization during Hispanics and Asians. So should we talk about that also? I think colonization was more severe than slavery. I mean, it ended way far later. Even African Americans, immigrants who came later after Civil War, they suffered also a lot. So do you think colonization should have a bigger role than slavery in media, especially? Because I think it's not been discussed anywhere.
Yeah, I think empire, I mean, I think empire is essential in talking about this and U.S. militarism.
Yeah, thanks for the panelists. Talking about advocacy and also making a difference, of course, you shared some worldwide issues and local issues. I just want to hear what's your view on the Mayor de Blasio's policy to increase the other racial groups in the specialized high school. So since we are all in New York, so I want to hear your expertise on this. So even though he said he want to have more like racial justice, but I think definitely it's a little bit skewed. And yeah, I want to hear your opinion on this. Thank you.
I am pro affirmative action. Whether or not the mayor's policy is the best way to get at it is a product of necessary discussion that needs to involve the community. But from, I don't think Asian Americans can have it one way and then protest the other way. I'm a proud beneficiary of affirmative action in job hires. We still have, look, we're pushing whoever the new DA is in Queens to make sure his office is representative of the population it serves. So we can't, on one hand, advocate for fair representation, and then on the other hand, say we're against it, you know? So that's one issue that we need to work out. The second, and very important, is from an academic's point of view, many of APA students are not equipped to go into the real world. They are at a disadvantage because they don't have the cross-cultural understanding that's needed to work in teams, that's needed to, reach a diverse clientele. And I see that, you know what I mean? And as Asian Americans are very concerned about the education of their children, they are also concerned about the jobs they're going to get. You know what I mean? And if we are not in a position to integrate that, we are at a disadvantage. There have reports that have come out about the glass ceiling for Asian Americans in various jobs, that they're steered into the technical fields and not into the managerial fields, where that's where the promotion lies. That's where the increases go because of perception that they don't have the skills to work with a diverse group of people. They don't have the skills to motivate different groups of people to get a desired result. You know what I mean? And so, you know, where does then that interaction happen? That's where I come out on it.
I'm really glad you brought up the SHSAT. And I think, you know, in my Asian American history class this semester, we've actually been focusing on Asian Americans and education as a way to understand Asian American history. And one of the things that, you know, and I'm also a New Yorker who's a product of a specialized school, though not the ones of the SHSAT. And in the 80s when I went to school, you know, our school was racially mixed. And so I've really been watching as an alum the progression that we are seeing, you know, how we got to today. And I think it's really dangerous. I very much support, you know, rethinking how we are assigning spots in schools. But I think more importantly, what's missing in this conversation is that there are over 300 high schools in New York City, and the vast majority of Asian American students do not go to specialized high schools, right? So I think that actually this larger conversation needs to be about public education and needs to really be about, you know, why we have specialized high schools to begin with. Maybe that conversation is one that is more difficult to touch in this moment, but the larger conversation isn't, you know? And I think that, for instance, at BMCC, when we talk a lot about the SHSAT and affirmative action, we're down the street from Stuyvesant High School, and the vast majority of my students, Asian American and non-Asian American, have never even heard of Stuyvesant High School, right? And they are New York City High School graduates. So I think, you know, when we think about the SHSAT and the position it's playing in our community and the division, I think what, you know, how do we expand this to talk more about other educational sites?
And again, I want to thank Rose Kim and our panelists for that great discussion. I just wanted to bring up one point that we need to keep in mind as well. As we talk about Asian Americans, we have to understand not just who Asian Americans were, who they are, but we also have to think about who they're going to be. Because again, there are Asian Americans who are newcomers to this country, and they don't necessarily have the history. Number one, our students aren't taught about this, but As a matter of fact, it will take some time for them to begin to understand these issues and to understand the racialized nature of the United States. It is just going to take time, and we have to reach out to them and make sure that these conversations take place, that they have an understanding about the baseline, the history, and so forth, because there are many instances where Asians and African Americans, for example, and the Latinos have walked along the same path along civil rights, the movement in civil rights. Because you'll hear the story, NAACP wrote about the Japanese internment quite a bit in their publications, for example. And then that internment experience also created a group of Asian Americans who were very supportive of the black movement because of their experience. So there are things like that that we need to talk about. So let me not hold you back from lunch. Again, thank you so much to our moderator and our panel. Lunch is in the back. We have about a half hour for lunch.